testing, the national testing, is used as the standard to calibrate the work of the states. We are in a great position there because we have voluntarily done the NAEPS testing for years. And so we're in a position to work and accommodate there. So in every one of the major initiatives that have been identified at the federal level, Oregon is well along the path and will be able to use those federal dollars to leverage the budget that you provide here in the Oregon legislature. I want to suggest that we have been able to use the report card that this legislature put forward in the last session to identify clearly how students are doing around attendance, dropout, assessment, and we are very careful in the assessment to measure both progress and a static position so that those schools that had a long way to go got credit for improvement. And that report card is showing us that improvement can and is occurring around those schools, and it's been a very, very valuable tool. I want to also, because I think it's important that we point out the benefit of the work that you've done in the past, the database project that this legislature brought forward in the past has allowed us to do the report card. Without the report, without the database, we could not have done the report card and the work around the report card, so that's been extremely helpful. I want to mention that in the budget, you will see detail as the next 2 weeks unfold about a data assurance project that is in the governor's budget, and that is for the schools to assure that the data they bring forward is of the quality that's needed for the database project to work fully. And I would just mention that the OTIS computerized record-keeping system of local school districts, a third of the schools in the state using that, is disappearing and going away. And this data assurance project that is in the budget helps replace that, helps assure that the data that comes in from schools is quality data, that we have uniform data systems, and perhaps most importantly, that our SIM and CAM work can successfully link up with the work that community colleges and higher education are doing around the prep and pass system. Schools do not currently have in place the systems that will allow them to move data in a successfully usable way between K through 12 and higher education, and this system will allow us to move forward to do that. I want to also just suggest that the report card has identified that we have some low-performing schools in this state. The vast majority are performing well, but there are some low-performing schools. I think it is essential, and we believe at the department it's essential, that as we identify those schools, we give them some help. And we have brought forward a low-performing schools package to you that will allow us to go into those schools that invite us in for help and provide help for them. And we believe that of the 50 schools that have been identified as low performing, approximately 50, that we can help half of those move out of that low performing status over the next 2 years. Now, Mr. Chair, I have indicated that there is good news in the work we're doing and that there is quality going on in schools in the state of Oregon. And I want to suggest that that's true. We also need to look at those things that need to be improved and work in assisting. We have an achievement gap that is becoming clearer and clearer in this state, where certain minority groups are left behind in opportunity that occurs in the state of Oregon, and that the full promise of our school system has not been made fully available to all students. And we believe that there are specific things that can be done to help erase that problem. The first and most critical is identifying disaggregated information so you can really see what the story is. And the Department of Education has, over the last year and particularly the last few months, disaggregated its information in ways that had not existed previously to give more detail around those figures and that information. And we will, over the next several weeks, share that with you so that you can get a greater handle on those issues. We also have had the work of the education leadership team that Speaker Snodgrass launched last session, in which the leadership team came together, bipartisan, governor, Speaker of the House, President of the Senate, educators, business people, and they identified specific recommendations around minority needs and minority assistance, and I just want to outline those to you. They recommended increasing minority staff representation across K through 12, implementing strategies to promote teaching as a profession in the minorities, increase the number of teachers with ESL endorsements, and reactivate the teacher, Oregon Teacher Corps, as specific bipartisan efforts that could occur. In addition to that, we have created in the Department of Education a task force for a quality and diverse workforce that is looking at how we can accomplish that both in the Department of Education and in Oregon schools, and will be over time reporting on the work that occurs there. It is my strong belief as superintendent that if the option packages that are presented in the governor's budget to you are adopted, we will be equipping the state of Oregon to deal successfully with much of the achievement gap issue that has arisen. In the dropout issues, we have the opportunity, we have disaggregated the information to show that students drop out for different reasons. There are concentrations of dropouts in particular schools. There are minorities involved in dropouts. And with the dropout prevention package, we can address those issues. With the low-performing school package, we are able to attack some of those same issues in schools that have special needs and special opportunities. And then I want to stress and plea for the teacher mentoring and administrator program. And there has been a tendency historically to say we would like nothing better than to help with the mentoring of teachers and administrators, but we just can't afford it this session. And that has occurred historically time after time. But I want to talk about the issue for a moment of whether we can afford it or not. We have 40 to 50% of our teachers leave teaching in the first 3 to 5 years. There is simply a training and then a teaching for a period of time and exiting. Often those teachers get the worst courses to teach. They get the most troublesome situations to go into. They're the last hired, and what they find is a situation where they don't have the strong mentoring and the maintenance and the support systems, and they leave the profession, and then we retrain and retrain and retrain and pay for what we would pay a fraction of the cost for teacher mentoring. California, Illinois, and Ohio have gotten really serious about teacher mentoring. I talked to the superintendent in California, and she said they dropped their loss rate during that period of time from 37% to 9%, a phenomenal drop, and I think worth us exploring and really examining. I want to suggest that the pre-kindergarten program that this legislature has been so supportive of is critical to the health of our school system. We know that many kids come to school not prepared. And over time, the legislature has provided that 50% of those students in poverty will have the help of the pre-kindergarten program. This budget anticipates that we move to 60%, and by 2004, 100% of coverage of those in poverty. These programs give training and counseling to families. They give assistance on how to parent. They give educational components, and they give a deep assistance to have these kids come to school on a level playing field, ready to learn. And Oregon has done a unique and I think really quality thing through your previous actions, and that is to match the Oregon pre-kindergarten program with the Oregon Head Start program so that they're one seamless effort. And it has allowed us to leverage those programs. You will find, as you look at this program, that it is more costly than the program in many states. I think we have a responsibility to defend those costs, and we can and are excited to do that. The level of quality of this program, the opportunity it provides, is markedly different than those programs in states where they have much less cost involved. And we have a much more intensive intervention process than some of those programs have. I want to make a plea as a former member of this committee, as a current superintendent for the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf, and the needs that occur there. I had an intense interest while I was in your position, and I do now. These are two of the quality programs in the United States. We have over 82% of our students at the School for the Deaf placed in meaningful employment or ongoing education opportunities. We have a zero dropout rate at that school. We have students that go and compete successfully in basketball, football, meaningful programs for them, are involved in programs of technology involvement where they sit on panels with their peers from across schools. But I want to urge that historically, those two schools had not been taken care of in the way they needed to be taken care of. You have recently, in several sessions, provided assistance, but I make a plea for serious consideration of one piece of the budget. There's a $500,000 approximate piece for salary for teachers at those schools that helps keep them close to the salaries in the Salem-Keizer school districts and other surrounding school districts. They've historically had an $8,000 to $10,000 difference in their salaries from those others. And it's created, for people who love working at those schools, a morale issue. But finally, they say, we can't afford to take this much less for our families. So I think that's important. I want to suggest to you that the quality education model has given us an opportunity to really look in objective ways to how we fund schools. And I think that the governor's budget's proposal on the additional $110 million that goes into this budget under the quality ed model is a great down payment on the funding that we need for our schools in the state of Oregon. The quality education model people indicated that there was a need for about $1 billion more. Well, if we can bring in that new $110 million, match it with the other that is there, we can make a real difference, and I think it will be important for schools. If we had taken pre-ballot measure 5, the property tax funding system for the state of Oregon, and increased it from then until now for inflation, our schools would have $1 billion more today than they have now. So we have funded at about $1 billion less than the property tax system would have. There are obviously reasons that part of that has occurred, but I would plead with you to stay with the governor's budget in this area. And I think there's consensus among Republicans and Democrats in the legislature to fund at these levels, and they can do quality things for our schools. We are excited to bring forward to you budgets for our department and for schools that we think will continue the quality that you have been partners in the state of Oregon for these years that we have been making great progress. We're delighted to answer any questions that you would have, and I would now like to turn to our state board chairman and ask him to make comments.
Donnie, welcome. A couple questions for Stan before we get going. And Stan, I can't tell you how delighted I am to be in the position I'm in to be able to work with you, because you've heard me say that, you know, if there was one issue only that this legislature could address, education is the answer, and K through 12, all of education. And I'll remind you again, we first met in the 69 session when I was in the House, and you were a student at Willamette, and working for Chief Justice Wally Carson in the majority office, and here it's only taken me 5 decades to become chairman of this committee.
Only taken me 30 years to become superintendent.
Sometimes some things take a little bit longer, but just let me share a couple of my frustrations with you that I've accumulated since I came back for the 95 session after having been gone 14 years, and it's really frustrating to me. In my Senate district, I have parts of 3 school districts, Portland, Beaverton, and Hillsboro. And as I recall, the 95 session when I came back, I think we were about 3.2, maybe 3.5 billion. And the budget we're looking at now is 5.2 billion. And my Portland school district says we got to cut 20 million out of our budget, Beaverton 10 million of our budget, Hillsboro, $5 million. And so, you know, we have to ask ourselves, where did the money go? And of course, probably accountability is and outcomes are overdone, but we have to take a very close look at how we are spending our money and, you know, what are we getting for the money. I personally think we're doing a very good job in the public school system, but I also have to say when people come to me and say, hey, you've got $1.4 billion more this biennium than you had last biennium. Where is the money? Well, of course, we know where it goes, but we have to find some way to be accountable. I think we are accountable. And yesterday, I was with Gordon Smith for quite some time, and we talked a lot about that list of 10 that you helped me put together, and we gave to Secretary Rod Page. And I said, Gordon, the time has come. If the Bush administration really means what they have been saying, that no child shall be left behind, we need help. And so the one thing that and he is very encouraging. He says he's working hard on it. For instance, and we've talked about this, let's, with federal help, fund 100% of our students that are eligible. Now we're talking about funding 60% eligible. And the idea of, you know, improving the professionalization of teachers that you mentioned, that the mentoring and whatnot, those things are so key because, as you know, we spend 85% of our budget on instruction. And of course, we want to continue to fund that well. But anyway, I really feel because of the reactions I've gotten from Secretary Page's visit here and the letter that he sent to me thanking us for his reception, and Representative Winters the last 2 weeks has been back to Washington, D.C. for the Black Leadership meeting and met with the Secretary and with President Bush and particularly J.C. Watts. And J.C. Watts was so impressed with what we did here in Oregon with the Secretary that he's bringing the Secretary to Oklahoma to do, and with the emphasis on the reading part of it. So I think we are focused on what we need to do, but now we need to find a way to really get it done because, you know, Gordon Smith and Ron Wyden agree, yeah, we got to do that. And you probably noticed that the new budget for education, Bush budget, is in incredible dollars.
Yes,
sir. And how we get, you know, a good portion of that large grant, lots of flexibility to it. And I think because of the reputation of the Oregon and schools and with Senator Smith and Wyden right there, I'm optimistic that we're going to get some help there, but that doesn't mean we need to even slack off on what we say we must do here with our local money. But I'll say again, I'm really looking forward to working with you, and I'm so pleased with this committee that I have here. They agree with me that education is extremely important. Anybody else have a comment for Stan?
Question?
Yes. President Post.
Superintendent Bunn, I'd like you to address a situation in my district, in Corvallis. What's happening there is they're losing their enrollments. And it's largely been because of parental dissatisfaction with the school reform. We now have two major high schools in Corvallis that are private, one secular, one religious, and they're drawing these students out. So the district is losing money, but it's because they're losing students. So I fail to see how, you know, giving more money when the parents are unhappy is a solution. So what is your response?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, first, it's true that school districts are losing population. Overall, our school system is increasing in population. It has been for the last 15 years. But there are a significant number of schools, particularly in rural areas of the state, that are losing student population. And when they had a property tax base that funded their schools, it tended to stabilize that more than a state-funded system does. Some of the things that I believe we need to look at over time, and this session may not be, for example, this next one, but we may want to spread the funding for loss of population over 4 years instead of 2 years and give more accommodation. And I think we need a study of that. I would not concur in your view that the student population is being lost because of unhappiness with the public schools. The information we have is that parents in Oregon are happy with the public schools. We have a higher participation in the public schools in Portland, for example, with much less population than Seattle does. And so we have schools that parents are happy with, but rural areas are struggling with loss of population overall, and we need to struggle with how to successfully help them. COSA has proposed, and I support, and the department supports, additional money for the small schools that would help out. There's a $4.5 million proposal that they've made. I think that will help. And we need to look at other ways to be able to help also.
Follow up.
Certainly, follow up.
In Corvallis, it is not a problem of loss of population. They have a stable population, if not growing. Why are parents willing to pay the $3,500 to $4,000 a year out of their own money and tuition if they're happy with the school system?
I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Close, I think some parents prefer to go to private schools because they have religious or spiritual beliefs that they believe can be more greatly satisfied there. And that's one of the primary reasons that they go to that school setting, and it's certainly an appropriate choice for people who have that kind of a desire. But as I travel the state of Oregon, the overwhelming message I get from parents is satisfaction and pleasure with their schools. Not everyone, and certainly not with every component of the school, but I see very, very strong support for the public schools in the state.
Just to add maybe one other explanatory factor to that, I think in Corvallis, because of the nature of our population, we have a population that doesn't have large families generally, is an older population on average. It's a very expensive place to live, Corvallis is, and there's a shortage of low-income housing where I think larger families are. If you look at neighboring communities where there's a little different kind of circumstance, like Philomath, for instance, those schools have been growing, and they're just 5 miles away from Corvallis. So I think it's where people are living. We do have some private schools there, clearly, and some homeschooling, but I think it's fairly typical of what happens in many communities. And I think most people in Corvallis think our schools are quite good, quite frankly, our public schools.
Other questions? Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last time we had this, the education budget before us, I can remember some testimony from some districts about how they didn't have enough money to buy current textbooks and do reasonable maintenance in their facilities and so forth, and some pretty sad stories. I also heard that those same districts were able to grant substantial increases to staff and apparently made the decision that that's where they'd like to invest the money. Given that we appropriate so much of the money now that supports education, how much do you think we ought to meddle in how it's distributed? And should we at some point perhaps suggest that either we write a cap on an increase that could be granted in contractual negotiations, or that somehow we state that, you know, it's your choice, but we don't want to hear necessarily the sad refrain that you didn't have enough for books if you did, in the instance of one district I recall gave away a three-year contract of increases of 5% each year. And that, you know, that's their choice. I'm not suggesting I don't think anybody here would want to be the school board necessarily, but we have a huge responsibility to follow the money.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, first of all, I would never suggest that what this committee does is meddling. Number two, I think there is a huge advantage of the current system that allows local communities to determine what the salary of their teachers and administrators will be, what the mix of their spending and effort will be. There may be an area of the state that wants to emphasize math and pay more to a math teacher. There may be, and so I think there is a benefit to leaving those issues local. I think it's worth looking and saying, as a legislative body, do we think any of the spending that goes on in local schools may have a pattern of being out of alignment that we need to draw attention to? For example, the spending level on teachers is different on the east side of the mountains than it is on the west side of the mountains. But I would suggest one of the reasons our education system in the state of Oregon does relatively well is because our teachers are highly educated and relatively well paid. And I think that makes a direct different result on outcomes for students. And so while I think it's a legitimate question for us to examine, I think it's very important to maintain that local control over that issue. And when schools make tough choices around class sizes, around teacher pay and other things, they have to be held accountable for their decisions, and I think that's appropriate also.
Okay, other questions, comments? Thank you, Stan. Donnie, welcome. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon to you and the panel. To alleviate some confusion by some of you, my name is Donnie Griffin. I'm the Interim Deputy Director for the Department of Human Services, but that is not the role that I'm here today. I'm here today in my voluntary role as the Chair of the State Board of Education. I'd like to give you some an overview, if I may, briefly, of some of the missions and the goals of the State Board, talk about some of the key work that's underway currently, and Stan has already chatted about that, and share with you some of the visions of the board that we work with collaboratively with the department. In fact, the collaboration that the department and the board have is evidenced by my being here and the invitation by the superintendent and the department to join them in the presentation of their budget before you. Now, the State Board by law has a role to establish policy for the administration and operation of the state's public education system, primary and secondary, as well as community college. Now, our mission is broadly defined and very wide-ranging. And with such an oversight, our focus has to be very clear. That is to provide Oregon students with education opportunities that develop skills and knowledge, potential, and self-esteem, workforce productivity, and to motivate and the motivation for lifelong learning. We have established three goals, and over the last 3.5 years that I've been on the board, those goals used to be a lot larger than that, but we continue to refine them, we continue to work with them with the help of our partners and with the help of the department and the superintendent. Our first goal I'd like to share with you is that each student will be ready to learn when entering public school systems and will be supported as he or she continues to grow and learn. Now, we believe strongly, and we support, and supported by our passion and supported by research, that one of the most important gifts that we can give a young child is the opportunity to start school ready to learn. Now, the readiness entails many features, but the key program that supports the concept is the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program. Can't express that strongly to you enough. Several years ago, the legislature set a goal of 100%. I think the superintendent spoke to this by the year 2004. It's a stretch goal. We continue to reach it and to focus for it with great energy. The 71st Legislative Assembly, our request is to adequately fund it to 60%. And that is a significant move. When we know that when kids are ready to start school and we spend the dollars up front, it saves us a great deal of time, money, and energy down the line. Through additional funding from the Emergency Board, we succeeded this year for the first time in serving 50% of the children who need Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program. And while that is a landmark, it is only half the job. Increasing service levels for this important goal is absolutely critical, not only for the next biennium, but because of the dividends that this investment will pay in years to come. And that is the essence of the policy option package for pre-kindergarten. Our second goal is that each school will make progress in implementing the Oregon Education Act. Now, in addition to coming to school ready to learn, our students must be supported in their continued learning by schools that draw upon the best instructional practices to help students achieve high standards. I must tell you that it was gratifying this year to hear the report from the statewide assessments to be able to look back over 10 years and to see the progress that we've had. 82% of the third graders in this year, in the last year, 2000, achieved a reading standard compared to 52% who had done so in 1991. 69% of fifth graders in 2000 achieved the math standard compared to 48% in 1991. Gains have occurred in every grade level for every test in this 10-year period. This is very good news. Similarly, our test scores have risen on a national measure when you look at the SAT, the ACT, and to the NAEP, or the assessment, the National Assessment to Educational Progress, and the third International Math and Science study, which is referred to as the TIMSS. All of those show, when you look at Oregon, that we're making progress with our high standards. Oregon students and Oregon schools have made significant progress in achieving these standards in implementing the SIM and the CAM. We're proud of our children, we're proud of our educators, we're proud of our partners, and we're proud of those who have contributed so significantly to this effort. But this work, there's more work to be done here. We're not done. There's a lot of work to be done. And together, the Department of Education and the State Board is working in key areas needing improvement. There is more to this measure. There is more to measure of this well-rounded education that is simply than simply test scores. And schools need help and support in improving the schools. That is the purpose of our policy option for low-performing schools, to help those struggling schools with necessary strategies and resources to provide a solid education for their students. And that brings me to our last and final goal, which is Oregon's education system will assure Oregonians are prepared to meet their roles and responsibilities and be fully contributing members of society. Now, major effort has been launched targeting the last years of high schools and the need to make that time very, very vital and relevant for emerging young students. The board has focused its efforts on the Certificate of Advanced Mastery, the CAM. The department has mobilized resources to tackle this important component in our educational system. The CAM is a system that will involve high school students in essential learning experiences that are directly applicable to their goals and to their plans. Now, you should know that we have experimented with this in something called our New Century Schools. We've selected a handful of schools where we have had great experimentations with CAM work. And we've had reports come in to us from those students who've told us what a difference it makes when they have real life experience in the classrooms where they can connect their learning and connect real life experiences. It motivates them, keeps them in school, and we think has a significant impact on the dropout rate. CAM has worked, has taken time to develop and required significant effort and resources as we assist high schools in embracing the vision to make it necessary changes for implementing this approach. It also creates a challenge for us as a state to create a system that is so relevant, so compelling, that we no longer lose 10,000 students every year who drop out of our system. We cannot afford to squander this precious resource. We cannot, in good conscience, allow these young people to make short-term decisions that had such serious long-term implications. That is the heart of our policy option for the dropout prevention and retention package that's before you. As Oregonians, we have much to be proud of in our educational system. Improvement has been called for, and Oregon educators have delivered. But more is needed. We are not providing the best education to all of our children yet. We have not solved the conundrum of families and crises, children who are hungry, neglected, are in poverty, children who are learning English and speaking to expand and seeking to expand their cultural perspective, which is different than those in their home. Many children of color who seem to be caught in an achievement gap which demands immediate attention, and children who are disenchanted and sufficiently disconnected that they choose to leave school for the allure of a job or some other opportunity. There are the continuing challenges that the State Board of Education, in partnership with the Department of Education, will work to address in the coming biennium. I should also know that this seven-member board, is not a rubber stamp board. It's a roll up your sleeve, service to kids, and let's get busy board. It's the kind of board that looks at the challenges head on and asks tough questions. We are challenged also by the fact that we ask tough questions, to have tough questions asked of us. So with that, I would like to share with you that we are very, very pleased to be on this mission with you. The last time I was before this panel, the Senate panel, a few years ago, Mr. Chair, you offered us a 100% raise. And so we were now making, instead of zero, double zero.
Thank you. Questions or comments for Donnie?
Yes, sir. Representative Close, Administrator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Dr. Griffin?
It is not. It's just old plain Donnie.
Sorry. I have two questions. The surveys that I've seen on dropout rates that are given to students, the response they most check for dropping out is irrelevant coursework. I'd like to know if the State Board has made any attempt to deal with the irrelevant coursework statement that those students have made to look at making coursework more relevant to them.
And I also want to give the superintendent a chance to answer that question as well, if you don't want mind, Mr. Chair, Representative Close. But yes, the State Board has looked at those issues and have heard from students themselves. We believe that if we design the CAM correctly, that if we can connect the real-life learning experiences that we know that children are interested in by the time they reach that dropout age, which is around the, starting at around 14, 15, 16, and then connect that with an academic approach, that we have a better chance of reaching them and making their learning relevant. The competition of what it takes to keep kids in school is very, very high today, and our school systems are struggling to catch up. I've taken time to visit some of our school systems, and I got to tell you something, Mr. Chair, Representative Close, they don't look very differently than when I went to school 30 years ago. Now, that's interesting because there's a whole lot more things that have happened. They're fighting to get computers in schools, and we need to do a better job of that. We need to move up our education system so that it matches where kids are in their life today. And I believe that as we look at the CAM, the opportunity to do that is very, very, very significant.
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, I would just second what Donnie said, but add a couple of things. First, in the work that's being done around the CAM, in addition to having it be oriented toward their real-life experiences, it also is contemplating an individual plan for each student that allows them to take their hopes, dreams, and aspirations and tie that together with the academic standards. We also are very actively involved under the work that was done around Senate Bill 622 of the last session on high-speed technology lines in providing distance learning opportunities that didn't exist before, that give students, particularly in rural areas, new coursework that they have intense interest in and have requested, and cyber school opportunities around what's called the Open Project. So all of those are coming together to actually respond to the requests that students have made for some different kinds of opportunities.
I have one follow-up.
Certainly.
Last session, we also had testimony that on the 10th grade SIM test, 70% of the students had failed that in 99. Do you have figures for 2000 of how many are passing that at the 10th grade level?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, I do not have those figures, but I,
I believe that the department are thinking about.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Close, we are just tabulating and actually have in draft form figures for that, and we will provide those to the committee, and we'll be glad to answer any questions around those. I want to mention something that I think is important in that regard. While approximately between 20% and 30% of our students pass the total SIM across all disciplines, there is a phenomenally higher rate of passage of individual disciplines, so that you may have 70% of students passing one particular subject area and 60% on another subject area. But when you require all of those to come together at one point, then there is a much lesser number.
So you will provide those?
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Schrader?
I appreciate the opportunity. This is a budget I think we've all been looking forward to having a discussion on. And I wanted to at least outline some of my major concerns that hopefully be addressed in the course of the presentations and some of the concerns that have been mentioned here. Certainly the dropout rates over time, I think, are very important for us to look out and what your projections are for the future. By investing the amount of money we're talking about here, the $220 million for the reading thing, how do we expect that to translate next biennium after that, into reducing those dropout rates? I think we're performance, more and more, this committee and I think the whole legislature is much more performance outcome based, and I think that goes right along with the SIM and the CAM. That's, I think, fits perfectly into your mission. There's been a lot of discussion, as the superintendent alluded to, about changing test formats, assessments, paperwork. It'd be nice to have an update on what has changed since the early inception and how we're getting at that to facilitate education, teachers spending time doing the educating and less on that. Are we getting smarter in requesting only the essential information that is necessary to truly evaluate our students' progress? It would also be nice to spend a little extra time on the CAM. We always hear about the SIM. You know, we always hear about that. But I think a good portion of our students don't go on college, and that's just a fact. And so where are we in the alternative pathways production? And I know I have at least one school district that has a huge vocational technological program that I'd like to see some aspects of it duplicated or made better or share with Redmond, and some of the other schools are doing some creative things. I'd like to hear how we're getting off the dime on that. This may be the session where with the budget and with some reallocation that we really talk about doing some things, keeping the kids engaged in something they are interested in, keep them from seeking alternatives. I also have a big concern about, I'd like to have a little discussion, may not be totally appropriate here, but a little bit on how we do figure out that cumulative standard. In discussion about, do we award individuals SIM certification for passing one portion of it rather than the cumulative portion? I prefer, personally, at this point, the higher standard where you have to perform it all before you get your certificate, but I'd like to hear the discussion. I am not an educator, and I would like to, I'm open to that discussion. I think it's important for the legislature to make some suggestions, if you will, in that regard. And the last comment, if I may, sure, would be, you've talked about several packages in particular, and certainly the big packages, the reading initiative, if you will. And the question I have in the back of my mind, and at least in my district, people are wanting to make sure they get the value, and some of these programs are, especially the small ones, are very creative. What happens if they don't get there? Say we put the $220 million into reading. Say we do the mentor program. Say we do the dropout initiative. If the school fails 2 years from now, I would be, at this point, a very strong advocate for taking the money away from that school. I would be in favor of consequences. If you fail, that school is in danger of non-certification, should be replaced. I mean, we have to have some tough, I think, a really tough discussion, I think, at this point in time about, you know, that yes, if you can do better, great, and maybe you need support to do better because you have unique circumstances. But if you fail, then you're failing the children of the state of Oregon. We have a system now where children whose families are unable to care for them, they're adopted out, or they find new families within a year. We can argue the social merits of that. But the idea there is that children should not continue to suffer while we at the state of Oregon stumble around trying to find a great education system for them. So I would be interested in the school board and this department and other experts about how do we play tough here, hardball. If you fail, there are consequences, and they will be hard and swift, just as hopefully we'll be swift in responding to some of your concerns about how to improve them, giving them the opportunity to succeed. We can have that discussion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, on all of these, with the exception of one, we have specific plans to discuss those, and we'll tailor some of the discussion specifically around the issues you've raised. On the uncoupling of the SIM, we shot it, carried it out back, and buried it.
Okay.
But if you still desire discussion around that, we would bring a discussion forward.
That's good enough for me. The others may have a different opinion.
Yeah, Stan, we will have a discussion on the SIM and the CAM, and I would ask Sue to track it. As you know, there's a couple bills around now to make it optional, and so we want to know the merits and the cost.
Yes, and we're very excited about bringing the CAM discussion forward in more detail, and we'll plan on doing that.
Good.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, I appreciate your interest, and these are the very issues that we do discuss in our board members and have ongoing discussions with the department and the superintendent with. On the issue of the uncoupling of the SIM, this is a very difficult issue that we have visited many, many times. And I can share with you that the majority of the board, if not all of them, have a very strong, passionate feeling around maintaining high standards. Our belief is that every child should achieve high standards. Now, some people think that's a lofty goal. Some people think it's impossible. I've had members of the educational community, when I've had talks and I mentioned that, come up to me and say, "Are you saying all children?" We believe that all children should have the opportunity to reach high standards, and we believe that they can. So we've taken on that issue, and we'd be very happy to share with you some of those discussions in the coming days, if you'd like. On the other issue regarding the failure on the reading initiative, I must share with you my own personal thoughts, is that sometimes we need to recognize that we will fail, but it's the effort to try, and it's the effort to go after such an important thing that I think is so important. Now, I can tell you that there's no one here who believes they're going to fail on this initiative. But I can tell you that with the great minds and the passion of the people from the department and the superintendent and the board, this is so an important issue that we're going to make every effort to be successful at it.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hobson, did you want to comment?
No, sir.
Okay. Senator Miller and then Senator Troll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciated the questions from the Representative Schrader. I thought maybe George W. had walked in. Let me ask about, having been there at the creation of the SIM and CAM back in the 91 session, I know we got all caught up in the excitement of Iowa Magaziner and the big presentation. Could you tell me how many states have adopted this SIM CAM approach now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, virtually every state in the nation, to a lesser or greater degree, has adopted a commitment to higher uniform standards throughout their state. Now, in some states, they made it a high-stakes process. For example, Massachusetts, who is now requiring the diploma to have this. Some were mid-stakes, like Oregon, and others are substantially back from that. But not only have all states worked to do this, but this is the centerpiece of President Bush's approach, that we have the high sustainable standards that are measured regularly and that we're all accountable for. And so all states have done it to a lesser or greater degree.
So you would find the two distinct certificates?
No, not necessarily. Some states have gone on a course where they're looking at the high standards as a sort of just the high standards, and they've not addressed completely the question of maximizing opportunities under the second certificate.
The other thing, Mr. Griffin, you commented that about the improving test scores and so forth. maybe I'm just wrong in this impression, but it seems to me, and I remember discussing this with my own superintendent in Lake Oswego, that some of the standards, you know, the standards or at least the measurements have been changed somewhat, and therefore, or maybe a better way to put the question, is the test and the percentage figures as to who passes and fails exactly the same as it was in the beginning?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I can't speak to the exact science of that, and I will open that up to the superintendent to speak to, but I can tell you that this is an evolving process. When we started in 1991, we didn't have a clue on how well this would work. I can tell you, though, that how we started was very well. We've tweaked the process moving along. We've changed some of the process, particularly around work samples and the number of work samples. We've had a great deal of input from teachers in the classroom who share with us some of their concerns and superintendents on how to implement this test, and we've been receptive to wanting to learn how to do it better. But I do believe that the statistics that are there from 91 to today are statistically valid. There may be some tweaking that we've done along the way.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, basically we are measuring apples and apples. The test that was given 10 years ago is basically the test that's given today in terms of the standards. The biggest change has been that we're testing more students. We've brought more minorities into testing. We've brought more of those students that previously hadn't been measured, and so that's even better news. But as we roll out our presentation to you, we will, in the assessment area, clarify further the apples and apples measurement of those two test periods.
When you say you've had, I guess, feedback on this, the assessment, certainly the SIM portion, and speaking from rather direct experience as one who has a ninth grade daughter, my own experience is, and her reflection, and I want you to know that she's an honor student, has testified to me, indicated to me that it's been a monumental waste of time. And I've gone to some of those conferences where this presentation of the portfolio was just, it was not worth her time, it wasn't worth the teacher's time, and it wasn't worth our time. Because we would, this information was conveyed to us on a regular basis at home. And I don't know if you've heard that kind of testimony, but I can tell you among parents, at least in my district, and we are among the highest achieving districts, that's a rather common thread. So if you hadn't heard it, I want to make sure you do.
Thank you.
Yeah, me too. I would just like, Mr. Chair.
Just a minute, I have a comment for Senator Miller. When you take testimony from your children, can you please have a copy of that?
You're right.
Yeah. Yes.
The same thing I've heard in some of my schools with teachers and parents. Question the value, and since it's such a large block of time, maybe it can be served better elsewhere. I don't know, but just food for thought. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, and really also Senator Miller, you know, I have heard students and teachers say this is a waste of time. I've heard the overwhelming number of students and teachers say this has really made a difference for kids in the classroom. But I think the proof of the value is the growth in student achievement. I think it stands there as a monument to the quality of the, what students are achieving in the state.
Senator Troll?
I just want to sort of follow up on that. I think you're right in a sense that clearly I think we've worked on the minimum. We've set some floors. We've pulled some people up. We've improved scores in a number of ways, and I think that's good. One of the things, though, that I think I would agree with Senator Miller and some of these other folks is that's not enough. The dealing with the minimum, we also need to make sure that we're doing so much more than that in the public schools, that there are exciting things happening and that they're exploring new areas of learning, and sometimes I think if we so concentrate on those minimums, we forget about the other kinds of things that we want people to do. Some of these kids are so far beyond the minimum that it does seem to them to be a waste of time to do some of the stuff that still is necessary to get done for other kids. So there needs to be flexibility.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to briefly share some of my frustrations. The one time I sat in on a class, it was a math class in Corvallis, fifth grade math class. The question to this entire class, based on the score reform, based on outcome-based education, which it is what the outcome would be, was to find out how many shoelaces there were in the school, how many feet of shoelaces there were in the school. The teacher wouldn't tell the students the length of a shoelace or how many students there were. So these students spent an hour trying to do this. They literally took their shoelaces out of their shoes and were running around trying to measure them, to which the teacher replied that not all shoelaces are the same length. So by the end of this hour, the students were totally frustrated, and I said to the teacher, is there an answer to this problem? And he said, no. This is about the process. There's no correct answer. And that really concerned me that in a math class, the students were not given any data. They were supposed to just work on this problem. The assignment was about working together, but they weren't learning math. And that's the problem I have with this whole setup.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Close, there can be descriptions of quality work and lesser quality work. And obviously it needs to be quality work. But I want to describe to you just very, very briefly the compelling work I saw around a fourth grade class that is a similar process to what Representative Close described. The teacher stood at the front of the classroom and said, we're going to learn about electricity today. And she said, I have a box. And the students were in groups of four students sitting down together. And she said, I want you to make this motor run. And she had a clock, because most students learn about digital things instead of the clock. And she had wires, and she had a motor, and she had a series of things. And by the time that class, and she has a series of words on the board, and by the time the class was done, they learned how to make the motor run. They learned a whole series of systems. And I watched a group of four students, one Hispanic who appeared not to be able to speak English, and an English student translating for that student, and those four working together, learning how to make that process work. And then I looked at the textbook that had been used 3 years before and concluded this, that the students who read that textbook would remember very little to nothing about what they had done around electricity, and those students that used that box of materials came out with an experience they would never forget for the rest of their lives. And that's what part of this educational change is about.
Thank you. Representative Schrader?
We're all sharing our experiences. I figure I'll put my two cents in. I have four children, all raised in Oregon public schools. I've done that for a variety of reasons. Some of it's to get the best education they could. Some of it, I think, is to get the best life experience they can, because soon they'll be leaving my house, and several, both my daughters have. I want them to be prepared for other things besides the actual educational community to get outside of my house and my value system. To the point, though, I have attended a lot of children's conferences over my career, and I have been markedly impressed, basically, with the quality of education and the quality of the teachers that I see out there. I mean, my kids are, I can say unequivocally, are getting a much better education than I ever got. These teachers, to me, are on the cutting edge of new and thoughtful techniques. They don't use every technique out there. I think they pick and choose, much as I do in my own veterinary practice, the techniques that work best for me. And I think I reach my patients, in their case, their students, the best way. And there's always an occasional one that doesn't quite measure up to my standards. But by and large, I've been very impressed, I mean, with the commitment and the dedication. It just is shocking to me, actually. And I figure I'm pretty much an education-oriented individual, having spent a lot of my life in the educational system. The other thing that struck me is the other day I went to an honors award ceremony for Campy High School. They give academic letters as well as athletic letters there. Okay. And I actually had a son that was going to this, and so I was pretty excited about this. This is good stuff. I figured, well, that's great. The school's got 1,800 kids in it, fairly decent-sized high school. he's a freshman. And I thought, well, it'd be nice. I'd be kind of curious, you know, how many kids measure up. Probably be at least a couple hundred, I hope, you know. And I know most kids don't go to college and all this sort of thing. Well, I got there and found out that over 500 of these students were earning a 3.5 or better. And this is a school that is, you know, not exactly upper class. I don't think grade inflation is a big problem in our area particularly. Covered a wide range of young men and women I saw marching across the stage there. But it was incredible. Almost a third of the student body in a medium-sized town in the state of Oregon, under our educational system, that, yes, occasionally falls short, but occasionally inspires, somehow is having a third of the student body almost getting a 3.5 or better. To me, that's incredible. I mean, that's, I wish I could have walked across that stage a few years ago. So I think there are some good things, too, and I think what we're all talking about is let's make it better yet. And so there are some success stories out there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schrader covered some of it. But I think the examples that we're citing here, both in students and in teachers and in organizations, merely demonstrates the complexity of this. We have as many children with different learning styles as we have sitting up here in front. We have as many teachers with teaching styles as can be enumerated by the total number of teachers in our state. And I guess that to me exemplifies the complexity and difficulty and challenge of what we are all facing. And I think that it's real good that we have this discussion and can at least identify the differences and hopefully give some support to the folks, including ourselves, who are trying to address these issues.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And Stan and Donnie, you know, that's part of the genius of this committee with Representative Thompson as a former superintendent, and you just heard Kurt and
Mr. Chair, I was late, but I wondered if you discussed one of your concerns and my concerns.
Jefferson High School, where Jackie and I both. Anything else?
Well, also you and I have expressed the concern, particularly of the 14. Failing schools in the Portland area.
Right.
And for both the senator and I, it caused some personal angst for us, since both of us attended schools in those communities when those schools did not have a high failing rate. And, you know, and we're sitting here saying, how can we assist in making things better in that community. We had quite a discussion here among the committee. In fact, within the Human Services
yes.
Committee, of what can we do to not only strengthen the teaching faculty as well as, and we know that there's a host of issues that surround it when you have decaying schools. But I don't think that any of us sitting up here are satisfied that we would have that number of schools failing in the community up there. And so any solutions that you would have, we welcome them.
We look forward, Mr. Chair, to bringing forth over the next several weeks the specific detail of those programs we think will help.
Good. We look forward to that because Representative Winters is Chairman of the Sub and Human Services in this committee, why we represent the 80% of the $12 billion that will be in this next budget. And so people are looking at us to make cuts. You know, if we're going to have to make some cuts, you go where the money is. And Representative Winters and I don't see very many places we can make additional cuts from the governor's recommended budgets in those human services and education. So we're really going to need your help to identify the priorities, and we really and truly, Jackie and I, are frustrated about our neighborhood, the North Northeast Portland. The culture was a lot different there, of course, two generations ago, but there's no excuse for what we have allowed to happen in those schools in that community. In some way, in this new millennium, we've got to change that and change it as quickly as we can. So I look forward to working with you on that. Any other comments for either one of the gentlemen? Just welcome down at the end down here. Okay, let's see. Sue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, I've distributed for you today several handouts that I'd like to direct your attention to. And there are three. One is a two-page, one-page, double-sided sheet. It's entitled Orientation and Background. And then you have a couple sheets of printed slides. And then lastly, there's the excerpt from our explicit analysis of the governor's recommended budget. And this is the portion that pertains to the Department of Education. And I just wanted to clarify that the budget bills currently under discussion are Senate bills 5511 and 5512. 5511 having to do with the Department of Education's operations, which also includes the special schools for the blind and deaf, the Youth Corrections Education Program, and debt service. Senate Bill 5512 has to do with the grant and aid program. And you'll hear how those, why we're doing these two bills concurrently, because these programs kind of go hand in hand. There's a lot of crossover. The Senate bills regarding the state school fund and the school improvement fund are 5513 and 5514, and we'll probably take about 2 weeks to go over 5511 and 5512, and then about a week to go over 5513 and 5514. There is some crossover information in these handouts that I've given you. The state school fund is discussed and the school improvement fund. But right now, for the next couple of weeks, we're just going to talk about the two bills, 5511 and 5512. So if I could draw your attention then to the printed slides. And on the front page, the first slide just says Oregon Department of Education. And the one below that describes in general what this agency does. And in broad terms, it implements the statewide standards for public schools and adopts rules for the general governance of public schools. And then more specifically, it provides technical assistance to and monitoring of school districts, administers numerous programs under federal and state laws, including special ed, compensatory education, and early education. It operates the special schools for the blind and deaf, administers the Youth Corrections Education Program, and then distributes the state school funds to districts. Turn the page. You'll see that next slide is the 2001-03 Governor's Recommended Budget for K-12 Education, and this is for everything. This does include the state school fund. So it's $6.22 billion total fund and 484.87 FTE. And that slide shows you the percentages by fund types. So you'll see the general fund is $5.11 billion, which is about 82.2% of the total budget. Now, out of that $5.11 billion, $4.82 billion is for the state school fund. Lottery funds make up $316.3 million, about 5.1% of the total budget. And again, the state school fund is a large portion of that, $257.7 million. Other funds are $192.4 million, about 3% of the total budget. Yes. And again, the state school fund does make up a large portion of that, $133.7 million, primarily because of the governor's proposed use of the tobacco settlement funds of $110 million. And finally, the last piece of that pie is the federal funds portion. It's about 9.7% of the total funds, and that's $603.9 million. And if you look down below to that next pie chart, you'll see that that doesn't include the state school fund. And so without the state school fund, the 2001-03 governor's recommended budget for the Department of Education is a little over $1 billion total fund. And all the FTE are within the Department of Education's programs. None reside with the state school fund's budget. And you'll see that out of the total budget for the Department of Education, the largest piece is in grant aid. And that's $214.8 million general fund, $14.7 million other funds, And I just noticed a typo. After the 14.7, there should be an M per million. And then $567.7 million federal funds. And that's what we'll be talking about in Senate Bill 5512, just for your clarification. And then on the right side of that pie chart, you'll see the other programs that are contained in Senate Bill 5511. Debt service, $58.6 million lottery fund, lottery funds, and $1.5 million other funds. The Youth Corrections Education Program has a proposed budget of $25.9 million other funds and $3 million federal funds. Special schools, $16.7 million general fund, $3.2 million other funds, and about $300,000 federal funds. And finally, operations, $50.7 million general fund, $13.5 million other funds, and $32.9 million federal fund. And then the last slide on that handout is just to highlight for you the major budget issues, not all the budget issues, but the major ones for the department's operations and grant and aid. And what I've listed for you there is, in the broad sense, the continued implementation of education reform. And you'll hear more about this as the department gets into its detailed presentations. And then caseload growth in the early childhood programs, specifically the early intervention and early childhood special education program and Oregon Pre-K.
As soon as we proceed through this and early on, I hope you can separate out for me, and with the help of the department, you know, the continued implementation of education reform, identify, you know, what we are doing in the reform and what does it cost, as compared to if we just, you know, walked away from so-called reform. And then also back on looking at federal funds, in the budget, governor's budget, $603.9 million. Find out from the department if there's any opportunity, for instance, to get waivers. I'm sure those funds came to us mandated for specific uses, and if there's a possibility that the department feels we can make better use of the funds in other areas, I would hope maybe the new U.S. Department of Education might have some flexibility in that area, and give us an opportunity at the same time to ask for more money, too, if we could demonstrate the good use we could make of it.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
So would you also find out if there are some new Head Start dollars in the Fed?
Yeah, I think there's some new federal funds since the governor put his recommended budget together, and I don't know exactly, but we should have those right at the outset.
Right. Mr. Chair and Representative Winters, this budget doesn't reflect those recent increases in the federal funds that you've probably heard about, and the budget will have some technical adjustments as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the waivers, Mr. Chair, the department, when it presents its budget in detail, can address that issue, if that's all right with you.
Yes.
We'll do it that way. And then in terms of the cost of education reform, if I could just say, Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question and one that I get a lot. And
sure.
So we'll provide that information to you.
Yeah, early on in the budget, I'd like to see the federal funds and where they're to be used. And so if there's some action we can take, why, the sooner the better. Okay.
And if I could just direct your attention to the one-page, two-sided handout, the orientation and background page. In the interest of time, I'm just going to drop down to the middle where it's got budget notes. And you'll see that there were 11 budget notes from the 1999 legislative session, and several of these notes were tied to special purpose appropriations made to the emergency fund for the Department of Education. You might recall that they were called accountability holdbacks. The notes required specific reporting by the Department of Education prior to allocation of the funds by the emergency board. And the text of the budget notes and then the action that the department has taken relative to each note are contained in this briefing document. And if I could just familiarize you with this, they're on pages, the information's on pages 1 through, excuse me, 20 through 23. And I just really wanted to familiarize with you with these two documents that they've provided. There's the one in the blue binder that's their briefing document, and then there's another one in a white binder, which is entitled Oregon Department of Education 2001-2003 Governor's Recommended Budget with more details, so that you are aware that those are provided for your information. Under audit reports, the Secretary of State's Audit Division performed an audit of selected financial records, federal compliance, and internal controls at the department for the year ended June 30th, 99, as part of the statewide single audit. And the results of the audit are included in the white binder, that's the 2001-03 Governor's Recommended Budget binder, under a tab called Special Report. And they also performed a similar audit for the year ended June 30th, 2000. The results of that audit came out after this was put together, and so it was transmitted. The results were transmitted to the department in a letter dated January 16, 2001, and if you want copies of the letter, I can get those to you. Probably more interesting to you is that the audit division also performed an audit of the department's database initiative project, and this project has involved establishing a system to collect various financial and non-financial data from schools and placing this in a database that's accessible to the public through the Internet. And also on a related matter, the audits division issued what's called a management letter on the uniform chart of accounts used by schools to record their financial data. And the department can discuss the findings of those to the audit report and then the management letter when they present later on in their presentation on this project.
Excuse me. Mr. Teacher, did you say those are here or those will be distributed later? I lost my train here.
They aren't in. I don't believe that they're in here. No, the actual reports are not in here. They will talk about the findings, but if you want copies of either one of those, I can certainly get those.
I'd appreciate that, Mr. Teacher.
Would you like me to just make copies available to everyone?
And that's the Secretary of State's audit.
Audit position, yes.
Yes, two audits.
One's an audit. One's called a management letter. It's not quite an audit. More like a review, I believe. Yeah. And then finally, they issued another management letter to the department that discussed potential audit issues for the future based on a risk assessment that they did. And again, I can get copies of that to the members. And then lastly, I'd just like to call your attention to the fact that there were a number of special committees and task forces that were formed during the 99-01 interim, and they didn't focus specifically on the department, but given the department's leadership role in K-12 education, I wanted to list these here for your background information. And a lot of these have to do with the state school fund issue, and will be discussed when we get to those bills. And I won't go over those in detail unless you wish me to do that, Mr. Chair, but I've just listed the names of the committees or the task forces, and then briefly what they were charged with.
So we probably, in order to kind of justify all those committees, ought to have a report from them, very kind of an executive report, a review of what they were charged to do and what they did and what's their idea of the outcome, because I know there was a lot of time spent on these committees, and we must at least make ourselves feel like we did our diligence in learning something from them.
Actually, Mr. Chair, the Legislative Fiscal Office is putting the finishing touches on a summary document that describes these activities and who was on the task force, the outcomes, and things of that nature, and that will be coming to you shortly, and the department can address these as well.
Good.
So with that, that pretty much wraps up my orientation and background for you. And if you don't have any other questions, I would invite Dave Fazier from the Department of Education.
Representative Schrader. And then Dave.
Can't wait to hear from Dave.
Yeah, I know it, but we'll have to wait a minute.
But I was wondering if LFL had any particular recommendations for us to pay close attention to some of the budget notes, some of the audits that we want to peruse preferentially.
Mr. Chair and Representative Schrader, they mentioned a number of the budget notes simply had to do with the accountability holdbacks. The department met the criteria in terms of what they were supposed to report on, and I'm not sure that I would recommend that you spend too much time on those. There was one in particular that was of interest to legislative fiscal, and that was where the department was asked to report back on a study that had been done of it. I think it was in 1997 by, it was actually contracted out by the audits division to an outfit called Management Analysis and Planning. And this report had a number of recommendations for the department itself. And the department was asked to respond to follow up on those recommendations to LFO and the Department of Administrative Services, and I think that there are still some good recommendations in that report that you might be interested in, and that the department could respond to this committee rather than just to LFO and Department of Administrative Services.
All right. Dave, is up. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Fazier from Department of Administrative Services, Budget Management Division. With your concurrence, what I'd like to do is concentrate on Senate Bill 5511 presentation of the governor's recommended budget today, and if we have time, first thing in the morning, perhaps do the grant and aid portion.
First thing tomorrow afternoon.
Tomorrow afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
What I'm going to use as a basis is my presentation. Looks like this. I think it's been handed out. Again, this is representative of what you'll see in Senate Bill 5511. It includes budgets related to operations of the department, special schools, youth corrections education program, and a fast-growing portion of the budget for Department of Education debt service. You'll note on the second page a stratification of all the fund types in the series of budget changes from 1997-99 actuals through to the governor's recommended budget. I would highlight in particular that overall the budget is down 27.1% from 1999-2001 legislatively approved budget. That's primarily due to the phase-out of lottery revenue bond proceeds, which was a quite significant portion of other fund limitation given to Department of Education for the last two biennia.
Dave, excuse me just a minute. And, you know, we're dealing with the governor's first budget, not his revised budget, correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. This is the original governor's recommended budget.
Let's look at so many budget figures now. The first budget is $5.2 billion. Is that the number in the original budget?
That is correct, yes, okay. Including the school improvement fund,
right.
State school fund and school improvement fund.
And you know, to speed things along, I understand it in various subs why they call, and they're speaking about the governor budget, they call it the governor's rec budget, and so rec works for recommended, okay.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. Page three gives you a breakout by fund type.
Yes.
$206.2 million, just for a general gauge of the different fund types and their magnitude within the budget. On page four, the governor's recommended budget continues most programs at current service level. It does significantly implement the database initiative statewide, does provide some continuing funding for continued refinement of data that is reported to the Department of Education or needs to be reported to the Department of Education and be in a usable format for policymakers to use. It addresses, as Superintendent Stan Bunn said a while ago, the special schools educator compensation equity issue. It provides for beginning statewide implementation of TESA, Technology Enhanced Student Assessment, and does provide education school improvement resources for teacher mentor programs, student dropout prevention in low performing schools. Page 5 is an excellent visual representation of the vast increase in budget for which includes debt service. 36% of this represented budget is for debt service. That is all lottery funded. Page 6 is a graphic representation of the total funds budget for department operations. Okay. This is, again...
Excuse me, Dave.
Yes.
What is the dollar figure for that debt service then, out of that 206?
The total dollar figure is $60.1 million.
Say again, please.
$60.1 million, which includes $58,500,000 of lottery, net lottery proceeds.
Net lottery proceeds?
Yes, those are...
You're talking about debt service.
The
lottery back bonds, the lottery monies pay for the bonds.
And so there's income each.
Yes, the debt service, the lottery bond proceeds were other fund limitation in the budget this biennium. There was a small amount of debt service. We're rolling up to an entire biennium of debt service, which is $60 million, of which we'll use pay that with $58,500,000 worth of net lottery proceeds from the lottery. Those you'll see those dollars in the lottery bill, and also interest on those funds, which we can use also turnaround use for some of the debt service.
Okay.
What's the roll up on that? Are we rolled up fully now at this point?
We'll roll up in 2003-2005 fully. That'll be another $2 or $3 million, but the vast majority of the roll up is in the number you see now. And we'll pay on that for 15 years.
15 years. At about the same amount?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, it'll be just about level for the 15 years.
So, and we're paying on, what, $150 million worth of bonds?
Senator Trow, I believe we're paying on more than that. It is $127 million this biennium. It was $150, I believe, last biennium,
so about
$277 million.
While we're on lottery back bond
over the years
and so forth, Sue just said for every dollar of income revenue from lottery back bonds cost $1.49 to repay that. So that shows that it's not an inexpensive way to fund the operation of school. I guess we all knew that, but that's kind of a remarkable figure.
Let's talk to the treasurer about that.
Yeah, right.
Can't he get us a better deal?
Pay things with our tax money. If we had enough tax money, we wouldn't have to pay all that extra money.
That's right.
Okay. On page 6, another useful representation is to look at the total of personal services costs for the Department of Education, which represents 27% of the total expenditures of all funds, and debt service is 29%. So we're paying, using more funding to pay debt service than we are for personal services in Department of Education. Beginning on page 7, we represent the emergency board appearances through April of 2000 for the Department of Education. As Sue mentioned earlier, the majority of the appearances for the department were due to accountability holdbacks and other emergent conditions. I would just highlight the significant activity that belies these particular items, reading excellence report cards, the education study and the statewide summit, charter schools, physical education curriculum, and also a change in the education program specialist classifications at Department of Ed to include a two-tier model, providing some upward mobility in professional development, and a change in the manager series there. On page 8, I wanted to highlight just some significant inclusions in the current service level buildup for the Department of Education and the Governor's Rec budget. For 020 packages phase in, we did phase in, as I mentioned earlier, TESA in the amount of $6.1 million. We've discussed lottery bond debt service. We have phased in into this budget the dollars for the Oregon Public Education Network. Previously, those had been in the state school fund budget decision unit. We've just switched them over into the operating side of Department of Education. We have phased out of the Department of Ed's budget $900,000 of general fund for the database initiative. We have finished a substantial amount of statewide implementation. And therefore, we have phased out some dollars, but as I mentioned earlier, there still are remaining resources there to ensure that the department has the flexibility to continue refinement of data that is required to conduct their business. The urban enhancement grants authorized by the 1999 legislature were phased out in the amount of $4 million of general fund. Lottery bonding to schools, we discussed, $100 million other funds. Senate Bill 622, technology funding to schools. We phased out $48.6 million in the Governor's Rec budget. However, you will see a request from the department coming back before their appropriation bill is finalized to include back about $25 million of spending limitation due to the timing of the cash receipt and when they can actually spend the funds. So they'll be spending those funds through next biennium also.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Could you say that one more time, please?
Yes, Dave, repeat that, please.
In the, Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, in the 1999-2001 budget, we anticipated approximately $41,400,000 of funds coming from Senate Bill 622 revenues that would be distributed to schools so that they can spend them. The cash is actually not going to be received in time to spend or distribute to schools this biennium. So approximately $25 million would be distributed the beginning of this July.
You say the money won't be distributed. Where is the money now?
I believe there's a combination of funding that is still at the department and still yet to be received. I don't have specifics on that here, but we'll have that information for you when the request comes from the department.
Is there less money than anticipated? Is that it coming in from that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, I don't believe it's a matter of less money. It's just the timing of the money that we did anticipate and their ability to spend it wisely and judiciously before the end of the biennium.
Okay.
And finally, phasing out the structure of Intellect program. $1.5 million of general fund authorized in the 1997 legislative session for a 3-year pilot.
Gene Kins is no longer here.
The information on inflation, state government service charges is there for your purview.
The question I just asked, the question, what is the structure of Intellect?
It was a big mistake.
That's a biased opinion. Senator Timms former U.S. Senator, what's his name? Well, anyway, they had a program structure of the intellect, and we had a pilot program of that here. Because don't ask me exactly what it was supposed to do.
It was supposed to take these kids who were having problems cognitively and helping them to rearrange their thinking and solve problems and turn them around. And was sort of based, I think, on not adequate research, and so we bought into it. It didn't work.
They didn't check the cognitive skills of the family.
Good point.
Okay. Dave,
maybe it's come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Continuing on.
You gave it a ringing endorsement.
Page 9 just is a summary of the...
I was outloaded as usual.
summary of the program option packages over and above current service level that were included in the construction of the governor's rec budget. I believe the policy packages adding funds are fairly familiar to you. We've discussed them at length. In particular, I wanted to highlight the program reduction that we had levied upon the department, as well as most of the agencies in the state during the current service level buildup. And in this portion of their budget, the social science assessment development general fund in the amount of $694,885 was reduced from their budget. I believe you'll be hearing discussion from the department on that issue during the course of their presentations. And finally, on page 10, just a quick summary of the new programs and the governor's investments and technical adjustments I've indicated as none for now, but we do anticipate having full detail for proposed technical adjustments from the department before the end of the, before we get to work session, Mr. Chair. And with that, I'd like to open it up to any questions.
Yes, thank you, Dave. Questions for Dave, Adrian? Did such a good job, we can't ask you any questions, I guess, but you'll be back.
I will, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave. Mm-hmm. Any other business to come before this committee? Seeing none, hearing none, we are adjourned.